Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today is Friday. It's November 22nd, and it's 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. We have only one guest today, Victoria Garrity. She's the mayor of the village of Ossining. And we're going to talk to her about the latest issues and concerns that engage the Ossining residents. I'm not quite sure, though, if she will be attending today. You know, it's really the week in preparation for Thanksgiving, and some people have gone away. So we'll have to find out if she's going to be in today. I'm not quite sure. And we were so overwhelmed with work. Yesterday, trying to catch up with a lot of the news that was coming out, I didn't have an opportunity to send out the information about the show and to her until late last night. Maybe it was about 9 o'clock, and I don't know what her schedule is like. So we'll find out pretty soon. In the meantime, just so that we don't delay people, I've gotten some work that I put together in anticipation for today, so I'm going to be able to, I put it down on paper because in order to be able to look at the screen at the same time that I'm going to be reading this to you. Evidently, the rising star is Buttigieg. Oh, well, thank goodness the mayor is on, so we're going to read that to you later. Let's speak to the mayor. One second as we pull her in. Good morning, Mayor Garrity. What a pleasure.
Good morning, Hezzy. It's a pleasure to hear your voice. I was just checking out the New York Times article about Buttigieg myself. I don't know if that's the article that you were referring to. He's a really interesting candidate.
He really is, and Buttigieg is young. You know, he's like a different generation compared to the other people who are much older. And at the same time, he's connected, but he's really a rising star. He's done very well in the polls, evidently in Iowa and New Hampshire, which is mind-boggling. And so, you know, the name of the game in these processes is to get to just knock down the people that are coming up in order to maintain the status quo as it began. But I don't know. I think he's got a lot of juice going into the race, but you never know.
Well, the New York Times article is talking about how he does have a tremendous support in Iowa, and it's looking good for New Hampshire as well, but what he doesn't have is the support of Black and Latino voters. So he may start off strong, but you can't win the presidency without minority voters in this country.
Well, absolutely not. So that's the obstacle the hurdle that he'll have to overcome if he's going to become a viable candidate. But again, he's also very young. He might find his stride this time, and if not, it could be another 4 years. So what is that? I think he's 37. So that's pretty young. So
absolutely, so yes.
He'll become known.
Yes, and he's certainly got a national name now that he didn't have, and with his military experience, There's a lot of interesting pathways he could take.
The one thing that I do find really credible is the fact when people are trying to demonize or diminish him because he's a mayor of a small little city. You know, it's like only 100,000 people, I think. But I still think that that's where the hard work takes place. It's much more difficult to take care of a small city or a small village. The budgets are small, and yet the responsibility is just as grand as it is if you were in New York City. So, you know, I think and it's much more personable as well, which I think is important because then you're able to speak to the residents there on a one-to-one basis, and it becomes much, much more intimate rather than removed, and that's important as well.
I think you hit the nail on the head right there with it. But Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head right there, where it's so intimate, being a mayor of a city, especially South Bend, which is certainly much smaller than a New York City. I'm on an even smaller scale here in the village of Ossining, but you do see such direct impact of your work. And every step of the ladder that you go up to county, state, federal government, we just get that much further removed. And so it would be interesting to see someone go directly from being a mayor of a small city to president of the United States, because while there are elements of the job that are analogous, being the chief elected executive, you know, there is such a different set of responsibilities and areas of influence on the federal level than on the local level. So, you know, his experience, particularly talking about Buttigieg, his experience in the military gives him an edge on understanding one of the big categories of federal government that we certainly don't think about on the local level. But I'll be interested to see how he's able to translate that on a national scale and convince voters. Of course, in considering who our current president is, past job experience is pretty irrelevant when it comes to running for president, apparently.
Well, also, he seems to have a tremendous amount of knowledge as well. You know, he speaks quite a few languages. So I think that's very important, especially when we're talking about the president of the United States having the capacity to not only understand other leaders, but also to understand some of their culture. Because if you can read another language, you also understand a little bit something. There's an essence in language and how people express themselves that he would be able to recognize, you know, rather than having it translated for him.
You are so right, and I'm sure the world would appreciate a new face of the United States that recognized the importance of different languages and different cultures and actually makes the effort to learn other people's languages so that you can communicate with them on such a more personal and direct level. I think it would be transformative for our role in the United in the world.
I think so. You know, it was very interesting. I never knew this until very recently, maybe only in the last few months. I always knew that Angela Merkel from Germany, she spoke Russian. Maybe because she also was in East Germany, where she grew up, and so I guess Russian was being taught there. But then what's interesting, and I didn't know this, is Putin speaks English. I didn't know that because you never hear him speak English, but he speaks English fluently. And even Emmanuel Macron, he speaks English very, very well. And so it's important. It really is important. So it goes a long way, I think, at the end of the day. Well, so, you know, well, what about you then? I mean, here you are. I mean, this is a great analogy. He's in charge of a city with about 100,000 people, and here you are, the head of a village with 40,000 people. Hey, maybe it's time to go there. You know, should we be planning for your running for president in 4 more years?
You should not anticipate that at all, Hezzy. No.
Why? I have to differ with you, because I think that quite often we don't even recognize our own value until other people recognize it for us. I don't expect you to get a swelled head about it, but when you think about what you've accomplished under those few years in Ossining is stupendous. And you've created a sense of value within your community, and people are engaged and involved and aware and in such an unbelievable way that I don't think other people see that. And the only other place, speaking of that, the only other place that I saw that was in the smaller village of only about 7,000 people in Bronxville. And I was having lunch with the mayor from Bronxville, Mary Marvin, on Tuesday. And so your name came up, and she said loves you to pieces. So that was wonderful to hear. And So there's some exceptionally good people who don't have the clout because they're unknown. And that doesn't mean you have to aspire to that, but I think that you have the qualifications.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for your... I'm delighted that my name came up while you were speaking with Mayor Marvin. You know, her name came up recently in my household because my niece was in town last week visiting Sarah Lawrence as a potential place where she may attend in the fall and play soccer for their women's soccer team. So I had an opportunity to sing her praises just this week too. So and thank you very much for giving me the high praise. I will tell you, though, as much as I enjoy serving as mayor of this village where I live, I don't enjoy the political game that I see play out at a higher level in government. And I don't even I don't even get involved. I mean, I certainly know Nita Lowy's staff, but I don't get involved in the political machinations at that level. But I am somewhat familiar with what happens on the county and the state level for candidates because we end up working together through the Democratic Party process. And, you know, so much of your effort is then focused on the campaigning and the politics and the negotiation and the compromise. And it just doesn't excite me. It doesn't thrill me. And you really, ideally, you would have people who would it's not where my heart is. I'm not saying that, you know, I'm not that old. I could change my mind if I see the light in a different way some other day. But at this point, I really enjoy the opportunity to serve on a local level. And whatever I do, whether it's serving as mayor or doing something in the private sector at some point, I think it will. I appreciate the opportunity to see direct results of what the work is that I'm doing. And like I said, every level of government that you go up, you get a little further removed from the impact.
I agree with you. Like I found the same thing. I think that I would be able to easily get a job in New York City working for the New York Times or some other publication, the Wall Street Journal or something on a higher plane. But I it's too far removed. It's not intimate enough. That I like the interpersonality. That takes place, that discourse is more important. And the other is too, like, I don't know, it's obtuse. You don't even get to know anybody. And there is too much politics. And I really don't care for the politics. I would just love to eclipse all of that and just get to the meat and potatoes, as they say. better ways to get around it.
All that said, there are some really dedicated and fascinating and brilliant people who are working at every level of government. And the vast majority of them we never see. They're the people who are doing the research and preparing the work for on behalf of the elected officials and helping them to hopefully do the very best for the constituents. And they tend to then focus a little more narrowly on a particular area of service or a particular area, whether you're talking about education funding or you're talking about gun safety or whatever the issue is, those are state examples. I don't mean to diminish the incredible, valuable work that can be done by people at all levels of government. It's just as an elected official, I love being an elected official at a local level. And I'm grateful for the other people who are willing to do it at the county and state level, many of whom are really, really admirable people doing great work. So.
Absolutely. Yeah, it just takes a different demeanor, a different sensibility, and there's a place for everybody. That's the beauty of life, and you could be excellent no matter what you do. And I've noticed that about everybody. There's always something complex, from the simplest of minds to the most complex, from the most complex of minds. So there's always something to learn. And that's the beauty of life. And I guess that's the intimacy of it all, of getting to know people on a one-to-one, even sometimes even if it's just on radio. So I got to ask you one question, which is so unique maybe to Ossining, with such a large population of new immigrants and old immigrants that made up the village and the town. Is have they all adopted Thanksgiving as the truly American holiday? Because I think it is the number one holiday that, to me, evokes America.
It is a very American holiday. I've spoken to families of recent immigrants whose children are born here, and it's their children that see Thanksgiving as
right.
That's what American families do. And so, yes, I want turkey, Mom. Whether you ever grew up making turkey the third, week of Thanksgiving of November or not. So, yeah, I think it does
right.
quickly become an American holiday. And what better holiday? It's not about gift giving. It's about getting together with family and people you love and breaking
right.
bread together and being thankful. So if that's the thing that America can be best known for to people coming to this country, then we've done a pretty good thing with this holiday. It's certainly my favorite for that reason.
I think so. I think everybody gets to adopt it. And it's an easy adoption, too. So, which is really very cool.
Absolutely.
So what else is,
you don't have to believe in anything except for family, good food, and gratitude.
Absolutely. And that's the beauty of it, too. And it's always nice because it gives people an opportunity also to be generous with people who may not have as much. So you can invite them into your home as well and let them participate, which is also great. So what are the most important things that are now challenging you? Do you get a chance to take a little bit of a break around Thanksgiving week, or is there a little bit of time to take a break, or is from Thanksgiving we go to Christmas and then we go to New Year's and then you have to start up again? Is there a little bit of a respite for about a 30 days or 45 days, or there's no time for the weary?
Well, there's always a lot of work to be doing, but I will say that the season gets so busy for other people that it tends to be a more social time of the year. So certainly we have tree lightings and holiday parties for work and such. It is also for New York State. It's their grant announcing time. They'll be announcing that in December. We pass our budget the first week of December, and so we've been spending a lot of time leading up to that, having our budget meeting.
Right.
Thankfully, we get through most of that. We're through that now, so we'll be voting on our budget the first Wednesday of December, and then things do settle down a little bit. Of course, New Year's Day at noon is inauguration day for Austin elected officials by virtue of the village charter, and so though it's
right.
not my inauguration year, I will certainly be there to welcome the newly elected and reelected folks in village and town government. So they have that to be planning. This is my year to just attend and cheer them on. But it's Dana Levenberg and is sort of the chief elected official of the town who will be
right.
coordinating that effort largely, while I am welcoming two new village board members on New Year's Day. So the end of the year is sort of preparing for the new year. I just had got together with one of our trustees-elect to talk about my first question to him, which I will ask again to the other, and actually I ask to every trustee in December as we prepare for the new year, is what do you want to accomplish in the coming year? What are your big priorities, and then how can we work together to make that happen? And how do they work with what we've already got going on in village government? And so that's getting underway. So I guess like anybody else, the end of the year is sort of a reflection and anticipation for the new year.
And that's another thing too. When you're not being sworn in for because your term is still in process. So not this year, but there's also a lot of responsibility to be there to celebrate other people's accomplishments and moving up the food chain, so to speak, politically. Is that difficult to manage as well? Because that's a lot of responsibility. It's like, oh, my God, I need another 15 minutes to write this speech or who knows what. How do you get it all done?
Well, I enjoy those opportunities. So that's a fun part. It's, if you have something worth saying, it's not that difficult to figure out how to say it.
That's true. So how did you become so smart?
You give me too much credit, Hezzy.
Well, I want you to see I wanted to see what other concerns are there. So this, in a sense, really, when you think about it, your budget is coming forward. You got responsibilities, especially around the holidays, to celebrate other people being sworn in. And so there's really a lot to do, even though I thought it would be a little bit of a relaxing time. So it seems easy, but it seems just as difficult, if not more so.
One of the most interesting things we have on the horizon in Ossining, and you and I think I've mentioned it to you before, that we have these Cornell graduate students who have been studying the future of our waterfront. On the 16th of the month, they're going to be coming down, and it's the end of their semester. So their project was to design what our waterfront could or should look like in 2050 and 2080. And so they're going to be presenting those designs to the people of Ossining on December 16th.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. And I think we're going to people are going to be quite stunned to see these visions of what our waterfront is going to look like with the rising levels of the waters in the Hudson River. It's quite disconcerting to those of us who love our waterfront as it is. And really, it's hard to imagine it being so different.
You know, I keep thinking, you just heard about the flooding in Venice. I remember when I went there a long time ago, I was wading through literally 3 feet of water at St. Mark's Square. And this time it went up even higher, something like 6 feet. And I thought that they had built these barriers to protect the it's basically like a lagoon, but it turns out that evidently it rusted. There was a lot of corruption in building, so it isn't functioning. Fortune of money being spent, and it went nowhere. But I think that they have something like that. The Dutch have a great way of holding off the oceans. But I don't even know if the old barriers that they set up are going to protect it if the water rises, which it is. And we don't have anything like that even in the city of New York. And they're talking about it, but they're still talking about it. That must be astronomical to be able to protect the shoreline from the river, like the majestic Hudson River. That's a powerful river.
You know, the Army Corps of Engineers put out some proposals in the last year and a half or so, and we actually had a lot of pushback on the Hudson River end because their plan to, as they see fit, just shut down the Hudson River access because of a storm would have really detrimental effects to the health of our river upriver. That's part of what has made me so conscious of the importance of working regionally with other municipalities. I think you and I actually spoke when I was down in New York City to learn about their plans for sustainability planning. And this work that we're doing with the Cornell Landscape Architecture students on climate adaptive design, they selected us, but they were just looking for a Hudson River community because they knew that this is something that's going on in the Hudson River. So we're a case study for others to learn from, which we're very grateful because they did some really in-depth analysis. But one of the big questions that it brings is what's going to happen to the Hudson Line train? And so having Metro North be faced with the reality of what we're looking at for not that far away is an important consideration. If we lose the Hudson Line train, I guess if New York City is underwater, it doesn't matter so much because there's no offices to go to. But if we lose the Hudson Line train, then we really that completely changes who Ossining is going forward. It's going to be a really interesting conversation for our community to have, and it's one of those things that it's very, very difficult to absorb the idea, even for those of us who, you know, don't question that climate change is a reality and don't question the science.
Yeah.
It's still hard for people to believe that it would ever truly impact our own lives so dramatically. So that's something that's on the horizon. Go ahead, please.
To finish your thought, I'm sorry.
No, I was just saying, you know, you're asking what's on the horizon. That's not something that happens because of the season. It just so happens that this year that's on our plate. So it's something a little different for us to be considering and thinking about and discussing over our Christmas dinner with our family and friends.
Well, it's a very, very compelling issue. I've traveled from Manhattan all the way up to Ossining and even beyond by train. And there are some really very, very low-lying tracks that are so close to the water, it may only be, 3 or 4 feet above the waterline. And that's pretty frightening because you never know when the water will rise up very, very high. And when you even go down on the West Side Highway in Manhattan, it sometimes goes so high that it's amazing how high the water is. So it's very, very difficult, and I really wonder if anyone's prepared. The financial burden will be unbelievable. I can't imagine how we're going to do it. I've no concept of it.
You bring up that incredibly, that is the question is how do you deal with this from a financial perspective? And we saw after Superstorm Sandy the billions of dollars of impact, and then.
Yeah.
How do people respond to it? Do you truly invest in the types of infrastructure and development so that in the future, when the next Superstorm Sandy hits, we won't see that kind of devastation to entire neighborhoods and communities? Or do you just rebuild pretty much as you had it because that's cheaper to do in the moment, but we're just going to have to reinvest again the next time it happens? And so being proactive is a lot more money up front and a lot more savings later on. And I'm hoping that if we have projects like this that Ossining undertook with Cornell, that it gives us enough valuable insight and really deep thought about the reality with enough time to plan for it that we will, mm-hmm. not just us, but in conjunction with Metro North, who is a critical artery for transportation for, so much of the Hudson Valley, that we will be able to truly make smart investment decisions that will save the economy for my grandchildren. And it really is only that far in advance. 60 years from now, I may not be around, but I'm sure my children will be, and certainly my grandchildren will be. And anybody who has grandchildren knows that's really not that far away.
No, it's not. It was interesting, not at this particular Ossining discussion, group series that you have, but I think it was the one 2 months before. That was a day that I traveled and made a connection. I don't remember where I made I made the connection at 125th Street. I was coming from White Plains. I took the train 125th Street, and 125th Street I went up to Ossining, and it was pouring rain that particular day, and evidently, some trees fell on the tracks. We had to, we got to the Yonkers section, and then we had to move back, and it took like an extra 45 minutes. But I was very early that day, so I didn't have a problem, and I arrived in Ossining very early, and I think I got there at about 5 in the afternoon. But again, very low land, and very susceptible to to the rain. And even the tracks got flooded. So, very susceptible structure.
Absolutely. I mean, that's what makes it such an incredibly beautiful train ride. I mean, that which is one of the reasons people, really commuters, enjoy living in Ossining is not just that there's an express train directly from Ossining that's about 45 minutes into Grand Central, but that ride is right along the Hudson River. What's more glorious than that to start and end your day than, being able to look out at the Hudson River? So, with anything that's very powerful, it's either powerfully good or powerfully bad. And so you just have to mitigate the challenges.
I was always wondering, now that you're talking about it, I wonder, they had concepts of monorails. And it's very conceivable maybe they could use the land as long as they can build something there that will be steady enough. They might be able to even take the trains that we have now and put it on some elevated level so that it could withstand water even coming in and inundating the bottom part without destroying the process. It's going to be very fascinating what these kids come up with because they're brilliant.
you may have a future career as a graduate student for Cornell landscape, because that is what some of the designs are. They're raising the track sometimes 30 feet in the air. Yep. Yep. Yeah. Some of the designs take it away.
So you mean I might still be able to get a degree?
Sure. Sure. Get your application in now.
Okay.
All right. Has it been so lovely talking with you?
Do they take 70-year-olds?
I don't think they have an age limit. It's graduate student.
Oh,
it's graduate
God.
School. I don't think there's a limit.
well, that is true.
I'm so glad I got to talk with you this week before Thanksgiving. I hope you have a wonderful holiday in your adopted home.
You too.
All right.
Thank you
so
very,
much.
Very much. And you all the best. Thank you for making the time. Be well.
Always a pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye. Oh, how exciting. It doesn't get better than that. Victoria Garrity, Ossining Mayor, always telling it like it is and always a pleasure to hear. So she's got a lot going on. Well, let's see. So now we have an opportunity to get on to talk about the rising star that is Buttigieg, who draws the fire from his rivals in the Democratic race. So the mayor insists he has experience needed for the top job, but faces a struggle to win over black voters. And that's quite evident. So Pete Buttigieg's newfound status as a front runner for the Democratic presidential nomination has made him the focus of criticism from rivals. During the latest candidates' debate this week in Atlanta, fellow contenders fixed upon the relative inexperience of the 37-year-old mayor of South Bend, Indiana. Amy Klobuchar, the senator from Minnesota, was asked about her comments that a woman with the same experience as Mr. Buttigieg would not have made the debate stage. And Mrs. Klobuchar said that Mr. Buttigieg was qualified, this is a quote, qualified to be on this stage, end quote, but added that women are held to a higher standard. Otherwise, we could play a game called Name Your Favorite Woman President. And she later went after Mr. Buttigieg's limited CV, his credentials, saying, I think experience should matter. Well, Mr. Buttigieg replied, quote, Washington experience is not the only experience that should matter. There is over 100 years of Washington experience on the stage. And where has that gotten us as a country? Fascinating comeback. And with less than 3 months to go until the Iowa caucuses, the first electoral contest of the party's nomination process, Mr. Buttigieg is gaining momentum. He topped the CNN Des Moines Register poll earlier this week with 25% support among likely Iowa Democratic caucus goers, significantly more than Elizabeth Warren, the senator from Massachusetts, at 16%, and both Joe Biden, former vice president, and Bernie Sanders, the senator from Vermont, at 15%. So other polls have also shown a surge of support for Mr. Buttigieg in early voting states of Iowa and New Hampshire. The mayor is a Harvard graduate who served in the U.S. military in Afghanistan, has positioned himself as an alternative to Ms. Warren, whose radical, bear with me a moment because I can't read this, I've got to turn the other page, whose radical, agenda has made her a favorite among the left-leaning party base. And he used last month's debate to draw clear lines between himself and Ms. Warren, whose support built throughout the summer before dipping recently as she campaigned on a platform of, quote, Medicare for all, end quote, that would in effect eliminate private health insurance in the United States. Earlier this month, Mr. Buttigieg suggested the party race was now a contest between himself and Ms. Warren. This is getting to be a two-way, he said. Elected mayor in a city of little more than 100,000 people in 2011, Mr. Buttigieg has raised huge sums of money despite being the youngest candidate in the field. He had more than $23 million cash on hand at the end of the third quarter, trailing only Mr. Sanders and Ms. Warren in the use of his war chest. and or in the size of his war chest, and the youthfulness is viewed by rivals as an Achilles heel in Wednesday's debate. And Tulsi Gabbard, the congresswoman from Hawaii, questioned whether he had the experience required to be commander-in-chief. Mr. Buttigieg replied he had better judgment than Ms. Gabbard, who met Bashar al-Assad, the Syrian dictator, while in Congress. And critics remain skeptical that Mr. Buttigieg can win over black voters, especially in the early primary state of South Carolina, where more than half of Democratic voters have historically been African American. And Mr. Buttigieg, who has been criticized for firing a black police chief in South Bend, is polling at just 6.5% in the state, according to Real Clear Politics. So focus groups have also suggested that Mr. Buttigieg, who is gay and married, may struggle to win over church-going, socially conservative voters, black voters in the South. And on Wednesday, Mr. Buttigieg defended his record as mayor and said he welcomed the challenge of connecting with black voters who don't yet know me, he said. So taking advantage of the debate's location, Mr. Buttigieg on Monday paid visit to Morehouse College, a historically black university in Atlanta, the capital of Georgia, and others were also making their pitch. Mr. Sanders was planning an event at the same college yesterday, while Ms. Warren was staging a rally at Clark Atlanta University, another traditionally black college. They are all trailing Mr. Biden in the chase for black voters. And despite, plateauing levels of support and persistent questions about his cardiology, Mr. Biden, 77, remains a favorite among African voters and African American voters. And a poll this week from Quinnipiac University and the University of North Florida showed that the former U.S. vice president enjoyed the backing of 44% of black Democrats or Democratic voters in South Carolina. So this is going to be a very compelling race, to say the least. So we'll have to see where all that goes. Well, I'm going to get to some other issues with you as well. And this is very interesting because we had this whole issue with Netanyahu. Netanyahu's corruption charges are threatening to actually deepen the Israeli crisis. So let's look at this. Benjamin Netanyahu will be charged with corruption by Israeli prosecutors in a move that threatens to end the prime minister's long career and deepen the country's political woes. The changes follow three probes into Mr. Netanyahu's relationship with wealthy friends and regulatory favors he allegedly promised to media barons in order to secure favorable coverage for him and his wife. A close ally of U.S. President Donald Trump, Mr. Netanyahu, 70, is Israel's longest-serving prime minister and has dominated its politics since the 1990s when he rode to power on his staunch opposition to the Oslo Peace Accords. In the past decade, he has introduced free market reforms and pulled the country from to the right, forging alliances with the ultra-Orthodox religious minority. And Mr. Netanyahu will be charged with one count of bribery, three counts of fraud, and breach of trust. The indictments come as Israel lurches into a full-blown political crisis, with President Reuven Rivlin telling the Israeli parliament yesterday that it had 3 weeks to choose a member to cobble together a governing majority of 61 seats or face the third election in 11 months. Well, both Mr. Netanyahu and his main challenger, former military chief Benny Gantz, have already tried and failed to form majorities after deadlocked elections in April and September. actually, it shouldn't be 11 months. I think it's going to be in March, or about March 17th. So what is it? It's November. So it's like December, January, February, March. It's about 4.5 months from now, and that they'll have the third election. Without a majority, Mr. Netanyahu is serving as an interim prime minister and has repeatedly vowed not to resign, even if indicted. And there is legal precedent for a minister to resign if under indictment, but that has never been tested in a case involving a serving prime minister. So if the prime minister resigns, the whole government collapses and you cannot reinstate him as a prime minister if he is acquitted. That's what Amir Fuchs, a legal expert with the Israeli Democracy Institute, had said. So Mr. Netanyahu already faces the possibility of challenge from within Likud, the party he has led to 4 general election victories, with his education minister, Gideon Sa'ar, calling for party primaries to replace him. And he has always denied the charges and the prospect of his removal from power and possible jailing has literally energized his right-wing base. Well, the charges against Mr. Netanyahu unveiled yesterday by Attorney General Avichai Mandelblit stem from 16 months of investigations by Israeli police into his relationships. And police looked into hundreds of thousands of dollars in gifts given to him and his wife, Sarah, by wealthy businessmen, including Arnon Milchan, an Israeli-born producer of Hollywood blockbusters, including Pretty Woman, and James Packer, the Australian casino magnate. And Mr. Netanyahu is also alleged to have used 2 trusted intermediaries to influence coverage at a news website owned by Bezeq, the country's largest telecom producer and provider. And he denied the allegations, claiming that they are the result of a left-wing conspiracy to topple his government. So that's the end of that. And now we'll move on to some other things. Let's just move on to just other concerns. Bear with me a moment. I want to get over to that. Where are we? Bear with me 1 second. Okay. We'll be able to find it this way. 1 second. Because I had some notes as well on the computer. And this is really quite important. We were just in Israel. Now we're going to go over to Lebanon across the border. Lebanon's protesters and leaders are holding a parallel National Day rallies. Well, Lebanon's top politicians made their first joint appearance since massive anti-government protests erupted last month, attending a military parade as the country marked 76 years of self-rule on Friday. That's today. And protesters staged their own celebrations to mark a first year of, quote, real independence, end quote. Demonstrators gathered for the alternative independence celebrations, converging by early afternoon on Martyrs Square in central Beirut, which used to be the traditional location of the official parade. And protesters have occupied the area, closing it off to traffic since mid-October. The demonstrations that began on October 17 against proposed taxes on WhatsApp calls turned into a condemnation of the country's political elite who have run the country since the 1975 to 1990 Civil War. They don't want the country to change. They want it to stay the same, and they want us to leave, said one protester who appeared in the square dressed as Charlie Chaplin and gave her name only as Joyce. Quote, I'm an actress. I don't want to leave this country. I want to stay here, work here, and live in Lebanon, she said. The protests since last month have brought together people from different religious and political backgrounds and given them hope of sweeping out a system that they say is broken. It's the first time Lebanon from all religious communities have protested en masse without a political party calling for it and against all parties said a 21-year-old university student by the name of Tamara. Tamara means dates. That's what it is, dates. I don't know why I couldn't even remember it, but those are sweet dates from the palm trees. So just so you know what that means. Anyway, that's real independence, one that's organic, and hundreds waved Lebanese flags, sang the national anthem on Friday, while marches set out from different neighborhoods in the capital toward the square, the epicenter of the protests facing the waterfront and near the government headquarters and parliament. The limited official Independence Day display reflects the changing mood in Lebanon, which is facing its most serious political and economic crisis in years. The leaderless anti-government protests have gripped the country since mid-October, while a deadlock among the top leaders has failed to produce a government 3 weeks after Prime Minister Saad Hariri resigned. Well, the protesters are calling for a new government and elections outside of the traditional sectarian-based power-sharing agreement. Facing a plunging economy and high rates of unemployment, Lebanon's young have played a leading role in efforts to topple the political elite they accuse of corruption and years of mismanagement that have left them with little options but to migrate. The actress raised a banner that read, "You people have the power to make life free and beautiful," end quote. A white banner was hung between two trees. Activists called on attendees to draw and, quote, be creative, end quote, about how they want to commemorate independence. And one person scribbled, "This is a popular Independence Day. Independence from a corrupt authority, November 22, is a day with a different flavor." So at the official celebrations early on Friday, Hariri maintained a stern expression during a military parade, while President Michel Aoun and Parliament Speaker Nabi Berri exchanged smiles. The leaders exchanged a few words during the 30-minute parade of marching soldiers. There was no display of tanks or helicopters, and no foreign dignitaries were in attendance. Berri and Aoun immediately left after the parade ended, while Hariri milled around for a little longer, exchanging words with the commander of the Lebanese armed forces. A day earlier, Aoun had said a consensus on forming a government remained far off because of, quote, contradictions that control Lebanese politics, end quote. He didn't elaborate. He also told protesters, quote, only dialogue is the right path to resolve crises, end quote. In an ominous sign, unknown vandals set fire to a large cardboard fist in Beirut's protest camp, which had become a symbol of the uprising. The first had been painted with the word revolution. And videos and photos circulating on social media show the fist catching fire at dawn on Friday. Protesters who were camped out in the square quickly tried to put out the blaze. A single protester defiantly raised his fist in the air beside the charred effigy. And local media said the protesters are preparing a new effigy to be installed during the Independence Day parade they're organizing. So we'll have to see where all that goes. Very, very compelling sort of stuff. So just bear with me a moment as we move over to some other things. And let's just look and see what's happening here stateside as well. The former U.S. Security official undercuts Trump's impeachment defense. In riveting testimony, a former national security official declared Thursday that a U.S. ambassador carried out a controversial domestic political errand for Donald Trump on Ukraine, an allegation undercutting a main line of the president's defense in the impeachment inquiry. Fiona Hill told House investigators she came to realize Ambassador Gordon Sondland wasn't simply operating outside official diplomatic channels as she and others suspected, but carrying out instructions from Trump. He was being involved in a domestic political errand, and we were being involved in national security foreign policy, she testified, and those two things just diverged. Hill's comment followed a blistering back and forth during questioning from Republicans at the House hearing. Testimony from Hill and David Holmes, a State Department advisor in Kiev, capped an intense week in the historic inquiry and reinforced the central complaint, quote, that Trump used foreign policy for political aims, setting off alarms across the United States national security and foreign policy apparatus. Well, Democrats alleged Trump was relying on the discredited idea that Ukraine rather than Russia interfered in the 2016 U.S. election, as he sought investigations in return for two things: U.S. military aid that Ukraine needed to fend off Russian aggression and a White House visit the new Ukrainian president wanted that would demonstrate his backing from the West. One by one, Hill, a Russia expert in the White House's National Security Council until this summer, took on Trump's defenses. She and Holmes both told House investigators it was abundantly clear that Trump's lawyer Rudy Giuliani was pursuing political investigations of Democrats and Joe Biden in Ukraine. Quote, he was clearly pushing forward issues and ideas that would, you know, probably come back to haunt us. And in fact, Hill testified, I think that's where we are today. And Hill stood up for Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, the Army officer who testified earlier and whom Trump's allies tried to discredit. He remains at the White House National Security Council. At one point, Republicans interjected, trying to cut off Hill's response as she flipped the script during the afternoon of questioning. The GOP lawmakers had been trying to highlight her difference with Zondland, the ambassador to the European Union, who delivered damaging testimony on Wednesday about what he said was Trump's quid pro quo pursuit of the political investigations. So the Republican lawmakers eventually wound down their questions, but continued with many speeches decrying the impeachment effort, and Democrats in turn criticized Trump's actions. Hill is a former aide to then National Security Advisor John Bolton, sternly warned Republican lawmakers and implicitly Trump to quit pushing a fictional narrative that Ukraine rather than Russia interfered in U.S. elections. And Trump has told others testifying in the inquiry that Ukraine tried to take me down in the 2016 election. Republicans launched their questioning Thursday, reviving those theories. Hill declared, I refuse to be part of an effort to legitimize an alternative narrative that the Ukrainian government is a U.S. adversary and that Ukraine, not Russia, attacked us in 2016. What she said. Her testimony also raised fresh questions of whether Bolton, who has yet to defy White House orders for officials not to testify, would appear in the inquiry in what was seen as a nudge to her former boss. Hill said those with information have a moral, quote, a moral obligation to provide it, end quote. The landmark House impeachment inquiry was sparked by a July 25 phone call in which Trump asked Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky for investigations into Biden and the Democratic National Committee, a still anonymous whistleblower's official government complaint about that call led the House to launch the current probe. Hill and Holmes both filled in gaps in previous testimony and poked holes in the accounts of other witnesses. They were particularly adamant that efforts by Trump and Giuliani to investigate the Burisma company were well known by officials working on Ukraine to be the equivalent of probing the Bidens. Well, that runs counter to earlier testimony from Zondland and Kurt Volker, the former Ukraine special envoy, who insisted they had no idea there was a connection. Holmes is a late addition to the schedule, also undercut some of Zondland's recollection about an extraordinary phone call between the ambassador and Trump on July 26th, the day after the president's call with Ukraine Holmes. Ukraine And Holmes was having lunch with Zondland in Kiev and said he could overhear Trump ask about investigations during a colorful conversation. And after the phone call, Holmes said that Zondland told him that Trump carried or cared about big stuff, quote unquote, including the investigation into the Biden investigation. Zondland said he didn't recall raising the Bidens. During Thursday's testimony, the president tweeted that while his own hearing is great, he's never been able to understand another person's conversation that wasn't on speaker. Try it, he suggested. Holmes also testified about his growing concern as Giuliani orchestrated Ukraine policy outside official diplomatic channels. It was a concern shared by others, he testified. My recollection is that Ambassador Zondland stated every time Rudy gets involved, he goes and F's everything up. Well, Holmes testified that he grew alarmed throughout the year, watching as Giuliani was making frequent public statements pushing for Ukraine to investigate interference in the 2016 election and issues related to Burisma and the Bidens. Hill left the White House before the July phone call that sparked the impeachment probe, though she was part of other key meetings and conversations related to Ukraine policy. She opened the testimony with an impassioned plea for Republicans to stop peddling an alternative theory of 2016 election interference and helping Russia sow divisions in the United States. This is exactly what the Russian government is hoping for, she said, about the current political American political climate. They would pit one side of our electorate against the other. She warned that Russia is gearing up to intervene again in the 2020 U.S. Parliament. We are running out of time to stop them, she testified. Trump, as well as the Republicans on the panel, including ranking GOP Representative Devin Nunes of California, continued to advance the idea that Russian interference was a hoax, and that it was Ukraine that was trying to swing the election to stop Trump's presidency. That is the Democrats' pitiful legacy, Nunes said in his opening remarks. He called it all part of the same effort from the Russia hoax to the shoddy request of the impeachment inquiry. Hill, who became a U.S. citizen in 2002, told lawmakers she was the daughter of a coal miner in the northeast of England, noting it is the same region Los Angeles, George Washington's ancestors came from. Hill said that Bolton told her separately he didn't want to be involved in any drug deal. Zondland and Trump's acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney were cooking up over the Ukraine investigation. That's what Trump wanted. And in Moscow, on Wednesday, Russian President Vladimir Putin said he was pleased that the political battle in Washington had overtaken the Russian allegations, which are somewhat or supported by the U.S. intelligence agency. So thank God, Putin said, no one is accusing us of interfering in the U.S. elections anymore. Now they're accusing Ukraine. Well, later on Thursday, a White House spokesman said that Donald Trump was an impeachment to go forward in the Senate because he would receive due process there. And he expects Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden would be among the witnesses. President Trump wants to have a trial in the Senate between a clearly because it's the only chamber where he can expect fairness and receive due process under the Constitution. So that's going to be very compelling. We should never believe or never expect to finally believe that. Okay, so I think that's where we are there. Let me just quickly look to see if there's anything else that we could share with you. Bear with me a moment here. I'm going to check in one more minute. All right, let me just see if we have this. Okay, got to switch over to different pages here. Bear with me a second. All right, so I'll just check and see what else is happening. Well, this is very interesting what's going on now in Iraq. Protesters have been killed in Baghdad clashes. The top cleric urges a need for accelerating reforms. It seems that Iraqi security forces killed three protesters in Baghdad today and forcibly dispersed protesters blocking the country's main road near Basra as the country's top cleric warned nothing but speedy electoral reforms would resolve unrest. Security forces opened fire and launched tear gas at protesters on a central Baghdad bridge. That's what police sources said. Two people died from bullet wounds and one from a tear gas canister directly at his head. At least 27 more people were injured. In the south, security forces reopened the entrance to Iran's main port, by the name of Hasir, which protesters have blocked since Monday. That's what port sources had said, but normal operations had not yet resumed. At least 329 people have been killed since the start of mass unrest in Baghdad and southern Iraq in early October, the largest demonstrations since the fall of Saddam back in 2003. So we're going to have to see where all this goes. But it's very conceivable that as we're finding more problems like this in Iran, it's impacting places like Iraq. Well, evidently Hong Kong, too, has got local elections, and to proceed as more protesters emerge from Polytechnic campus, police will be out in force at election stations in Hong Kong this weekend as keenly contested local elections take place amid ongoing anti-government protests. And Hong Kong's new police commissioner, Tang Ping-Kung, told reporters on Thursday that officers deal with any outbreaks of unless European demeanor. So I think that's where we are today. So we don't have anything more to discuss with you today. I don't think that there's anything special there. It's the weekend, so we'll be talking to you on Monday when we have John Bailey from the White Plains Citizenet reporter, publisher, and editor. And then we're going to also have, of course, Michael Edelman, the political pundit. There will be a lot to discuss with him, that's for sure. So, again, I want to thank you for being with us and appreciate your being with us. And I guess that's about it. So I'll go back to our studio screen and just simply say, have a great weekend. All the best. Goodbye.
Mm-hmm.